Did you set up? Primary, excellent. Oops, that's not the side you're supposed to see. Sorry, just one moment. Hi. All right. All set.
So, welcome to this slot in the program. This time we have Michael Sworn, is that his
name? Sworn.
Sworn, which is a well-known Perl hacker. He has been working on a lot of free software projects in the Perl community, and he's here to talk about reusable code.
Yeah, I'll tell them what I'm talking about. Thank you. Hi, I'm Michael Sworn, and you might know me from such pro modules as Testmore and MicMaker that installs most of the pro modules that are out there, and things like ClassDBI. Just to get out of the way, I wear these funny shoes that everybody's sort of like looking at, and they're always glancing over, and nobody really wants to ask me about them. And if you want a pair, there you go. They don't pay me a dime for this, but I figured I'd just get it out of the way early on. I don't know if they sell them in here, but I quite like them. So I'd like to encourage everybody to ask questions, because it'll be a much better presentation if you do, because you may realize I am not from here, so I don't necessarily know what you guys want to hear and what your particular problems are and all that. So ask lots of questions, and I think it'll be a better presentation for it and make me happy. And if later on you come up with something, you can reach me here. So, like I said, I program Perl. And Perl is part of Unix, whether officially or not. If you get a Unix machine, it's probably depending pretty damn heavily on Perl. Debian uses Perl for everything. FreeBSD relies on it heavily. Solaris, OpenBSD probably doesn't install it by default, but it'll probably last about 5 minutes before something pulls it in. So Perl absolutely has to work. Absolutely must work. Yes?
OpenBSD uses Perl for its packaging system, in fact.
OpenBSD uses it for its packages?
Yes.
Okay, well, there you go. Absolutely must have to work. And then there's the Comprehensive Perl Archive Network. And Adam Kennedy yesterday gave me a fabulous one-hour introduction to my talk. So I don't think I have to go over that. If everybody was in there to see it, and if you weren't, ask the person next to you about it. And CPAN is big. CPAN is really big, and it's also half of Perl. It's integral to Perl. It's part of Perl's power because it allows you to do this massive customization of the language and grab anything you want. So if CPAN breaks, Perl breaks. We can't live without it. And Perl breaks. Unix breaks, and so CPAN absolutely must have to work. And I'm telling you this because the things that I'm going to be talking about here are not for toys. They are for really, really serious, mission-critical, absolutely must work systems. And they do work remarkably well. Despite what Adam Kennedy said yesterday about the sewage problem. And unfortunately, I don't have any really fancy videos in here. I'm not going to show you big rivers of crap flowing, although if you really wanted to, I could take a dump on the stage, but I won't do that. But there will be crap in this presentation because, like I said, CPAN is serious business, but 90% of CPAN is crap. Much like most of everything is crap, 90% of everything is crap. Of course, present company excluded. You're all wonderful. But that's all right, because ideally, you'll never even see this stuff. It'll just all float to the bottom, and you'll see the cream will float to the top. And nobody really ever uses it for very long. Only about 10% that's really good ever actually gets used. And one might say, isn't that really inefficient? Wouldn't it be great if it could be only 80% crap? Isn't all of that crap being generated just a waste? And yes, it is inefficient, but maybe democracy is the worst form of government except for all the rest. Maybe this is simply the least inefficient system in the long run. So let me diverge for a little bit and to say that why I'm actually here. So I'm actually here to attend the Oslo QA Hackathon a couple days ago. And it was basically a bunch of pro programmers all sitting around in a room, or many rooms, talking about all these issues that to improve CPAN and improve Perl testing, and as an intensive 3-day conference to get all these people together who normally just argue over mailing lists. And now we can argue together in a room, and the arguments simply go a lot faster. So we got a lot of stuff done there. And it was sponsored by Limpro. Thank you very much, Limpro. We had it at their offices. And Salva Nielsen set this whole thing up. So he just shocked at what he had spawned, I think. And he knows folks here at this conference. Perl is broke. You guys have money. So they signed me up at this conference to fly me out to Norway so I could attend the thing. So now I'm singing for my supper. And I don't really particularly know a whole lot about Norwegian politics. Rika and Salva, and they explained a lot of the situations to me. I'm not really particularly tied into open source. The whole ISO thing, I had no idea that was going on. I know Perl. I do my thing. I do it well. And I spent a lot of time trying to figure out what you guys might want to hear, what might be relevant to your situation. I don't really know what your situation is, and I came up with something about, it's a government conference, and they're trying to look into open source, and maybe they want to know something about how they can have different municipalities sharing code together, and something. So that's what wound up on the program, and I came up with something, but it was a bit of a stretch, and I don't do really well when I'm just making stuff up. So it was a fine sign that the talk was going to be crap. And I asked Rika when I got here what they really want to hear, and they said, well, be technical. Well, Rika and Dennis said this. Be technical, be profound, and be inspiring. And I'm actually not going to be very technical in this talk. But I will try and be profound and inspiring, and I know that I can do that because the hackathon, for me, was very profound and inspiring and kind of gelled a lot of things that I hadn't really thought out clearly before. So I'm going to talk about that. I'm going to talk about what I did on my Norwegian vacation, and I hope nobody minds, and I swear it will actually have something to do with the original topic eventually. So I just got back from working with all these fantastic people, right? There they are. We're to blame. And one of the questions is, why us? Why this bunch of people? Why did we get together? Why not somebody else? And of course, we have, we all have something to do with Perl. We all have something to do with QA. But does that mean that we're testing experts? And no, we're not testing experts. So that must mean that we have fancy degrees. No, I'm a college dropout. Andy Armstrong, I think he ever went to college, right? No. Adam Kennedy doesn't have a degree. Curtis Poe has an associate's degree. We don't, So then we must work for big companies. No, I'm self-employed. I think I made about, 150,000 kroner last year. Not a whole lot, relatively speaking. We work for tiny little companies. So why this group? Why not somebody else? We do things, we put them up on the CPAN, and then people use our stuff. That's it. That's why. We're selected by use. We're selected because we're the people who do the things that people use. It's not a meritocracy. We're not the best people for the job. And maybe we are in some way, but how do you select what is best and what is best? And you can have huge arguments, and we do all the time, about what is the best thing to do and who is the best, what's the best tool and what's the best system. So a meritocracy, the problem with that is how do you select what is best? And it's not necessarily a duocracy. We're not just the people who do, because there's 2,000 other people on CPAN who do. But where, and 90% of CPAN is crap and doesn't really get used. So lots of people, 2,000 people did, but where are the people who got used? So we're a usedocracy, and that sounds absolutely horrible, but it's at least accurate, and we're geeks, and we go for accuracy over sounding good, right? So that's it. That's it. We're there because our stuff is useful. It doesn't matter if it's actually garbage on the inside, or if it's perfect, or if it's not perfect. People seem to have a use for it. And it's an excellent selection mechanism. We were selected by actual use, not by poll, and not by vote, and not by asking people what they think they want or what they think they need, but we were selected by actually what they need. Because use illustrates need, and use is a measurable quantity. We can look at the downloads, we can add phone home stuff into the software so that we know when it's been installed and used. Debian has its popularity contest. We can go to the vendors and ask them what's being used and what they like. We can look at mailing list activity. We can look at how robust the community is, how many patches they're getting, and all this kind of information with forks and everything. We can measure this in some way, and it links very, very closely to actual use and to need. So it's a very healthy system to select by use, because what we actually want to do is find out what people need and provide it to them. And if our polling system is actually that, it's a very direct polling system, it's a direct tap into what people need. And that is the usedocracy. Horrible name. Please, if anybody has something better, let me know. Use is evolutionary. People use something in a certain way, and then they get used to it. It gets simpler and simpler and simpler. And then once that becomes really easy and fast and simple, you can move on to the next level of complexity. And then that one, the system adapts to that and becomes easier and easier and easier, and you move on to the next level of complexity. And what we call this is paving the cow paths, or in America, paving the wagon trails, or I guess here, paving the sleigh tracks. What we were doing at the hackathon is that we were taking what we know that everybody does and needs to do and is trying to do, but it's actually, it's a little bit more difficult than it should be, and the system doesn't totally support it. And we wanted to describe this system a little bit more formally, because the community had grown too large for conventions and for word of mouth and for just simply getting best practice by finding it. We really wanted to have some standards and some specs and some definitive guides to say, this is how we have discovered is the way to do it, and you should probably do it this way, so that new people entering the community could find out what to do. And this is actually how English dictionaries work. The Oxford English Dictionary is what's called a descriptive dictionary. They are describing current use of the English language. And they don't try and they don't have, not supposed to have any opinion on anything that is a wrong word. Woot entered the English dictionary recently. I don't know if it's in the OED yet, but it entered, I think, American Heritage. Ain't is in there. Everything is in there because they're simply describing current use. And if a dictionary gets away with this, what we think of as language authoritative sort of thing, no, it's actually not authoritative at all. And it works remarkably well. I mean, this is the greatest dictionary in the world, at least in the English speaking world. The opposite of descriptive is proscriptive. So that you want to line things up and say, this is what you can't do, we're not allowing this because whatever, because you might do it wrong, because we think nobody's ever going to do it this way, because we don't think it's useful. And most of the time when we wanted to be proscriptive, we found at the hackathon, we had strayed off the cow paths. We had gone into new territory that nobody had really ever dealt with before. Like, we introduced some new feature, and then we were thinking about, well, what do we allow with this new feature that we don't really know anything about, we don't know how it's going to be used? And there were really two camps. There was the proscribers who said, well, it's probably going to be used like this, therefore we don't want to allow anything else. And there were the describers which said, well, we don't really know what they're doing at all, we don't really have any idea, so just allow it, just let it happen. And then we'll find out, we'll see where the cows go, and we'll see where the wagons go and the reindeer go, And then we will do another iteration and describe that. But it has to be, the system has to be evolutionary in order to be, to have that process happen. You pave out to a certain point, then you stop, then you let the pioneers go forward, and then you pave out a little bit more. And every time we tried to prescribe, it all went to hell. It caused implementation problems. Like the next day, we would prescribe something, and then we go to implement it the next day, and we find out immediately, oh, we can't do that. You know, if we prescribe this, it makes the implementation hell. So it almost always went to hell, because if you try and prescribe the potentially bad, you also wind up prescribing the potentially good. Because what you're really doing is you're prescribing change. You're disallowing change. You're saying that nobody will ever want to do it this way, and this way or this way is never a good idea, and will never be a good idea. Tomorrow, a year from now, 10 years from now, and you bet everything on that bet. You bet everything on predicting the future. And you bet everything on that you understand every way that it's going to be used. And my prediction for the future, here is my prediction for the future, that your prediction is wrong. And I'll win every time. Because, well, not every time, but I'll win in the odds. Because so many people make so many predictions over so much time. And odds are they're just going to be wrong because they don't have enough information, because the world is so big, because change is so unpredictable and chaotic and all that. And this really is over a long time. CPAN is 12 years old, and Perl 5 is 14 years old, and Perl is 20 years old. Anybody here who is younger than Perl? Or close? Yeah, one. See? It's still around. Who would have predicted that you would have been born? Linux is 17 years old. I mean, you know, there are people coming out of high school that, or primary school, whatever you call it over here, I'm sorry. What do you call high school over here? The final? Okay, I can't say that. So if you are descriptive, you only describe as much as you need for in order to pave out what people, only describe as much as you need in order to pave what people are already using, in order to help what people are already doing, in order to help new people coming in to do the best practices, the agreed upon best practices, then you leave the rest open as a user playground. Even the things that look awful, even the things that, you know, you look at it and you go, oh my God, why would you ever want to do this? There's a particular feature of Test More that's really, really useful. The skip blocks, if anybody's familiar with it. It allows you to put a block around a whole bunch of code. And then inside the code, you do the logic necessary to decide if you need to run the code. And then if you don't, it never even executes it. It jumps right out of it. It jumps right out of that block. And it's very, a very important and very clever feature. And it relies upon a feature of the language that 3 months before I had been railing about and saying, oh my God, this is horrible. I can't believe we do this thing. Get it out of the language. Ah! And then it turned out to be just the little bit of flexibility that I needed to implement this really powerful feature. And that nobody knows about it. Nobody knows that it works. The great thing about hacks is that if you encapsulate them properly, sufficiently encapsulated hacks, sufficiently encapsulated magic is technology. Right. Yeah. So allowing these little things can provide huge levers to do really amazing things far, far, far down the road. Descriptive is about embracing change, because the world is going to change, and technologies are going to change, and people are going to change, and needs are going to change. And it's a very safe bet that things are going to change. Your system must deal with change. And you can't really predict change. For example, who could have predicted the web? 15 years ago, 1993, NCSA Mosaic came out, and that was when the web kind of hit the mainstream. You know, before Netscape, and Netscape came out, I think, shortly thereafter, the next year. Perl predated it by 5-6 years. And Perl became the language for the web for a time. We hadn't, you know, but all just because we had this flexibility built in. Unix predated the web by 20 or 30 years. And if Unix became the web server, you know, Apache destroyed everything. It's only now that anything else is eking its way out. So who had all the trouble with the web? Windows 95. Windows 95, made 2 years after NCSA Mosaic, could not handle the internet. It was not set up to deal with it, and Microsoft took until XP and Vista, I don't know how many years later, to finally sort out their internet policy. It completely blindsided them. They had no idea, because they got a bit prescriptive, and they had their idea about how the world works, and suddenly the world changed out from under them. And they almost lost it all. They may yet do it. What's going on across the street is any indication. So control of change can lead to death. Your project can die because you can paint yourself into a corner, and then everything else shifts out. You adapt very well to a current situation, and the situation changes radically off from underneath you, and you can't shift with it. Or controlling change is really painful. In Microsoft's case, it looks like they're going to survive it. So what descriptive really does is, descriptive is not only about embracing change, it's about embracing chaos. Chaos in the sense of that it's change that you do not control and can go in any direction at any given time. And you're just surfing along the top, getting the 10% out, because 90% of all change is crap. But in 90% of everything is crap, but the 10% that is not is extremely important, and you cannot predict it. If you try and make less crap, you will usually wind up eliminating, shaving off the 10% as well, because you can't decide what is useful and what is not at that point. And so it turns out that taking a big crap is actually healthy. it's all great when the scatological jokes come out.
Is that when you're being profound?
Profound about crap, yeah. And it turns out that at times one man's crap is another man's gold, or one man's trash is another man's gold. And this happened at the hackathon. We were introduced to this thing called ASCIO. And ASCIO was Visio for ASCII art. ASCIO allowed you to draw these ASCII art tables and diagrams and all these things that you would normally have to reach for Visio or some sort of graphical widget for, and he did it all in ASCII art. It's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. It lets you draw things like that really easily. That would be, you know, and you want to do this stuff all the time if you're text-based like I am, and you want to write something out in an email and send it on. You don't want to put in an image or HTML or anything like that. It's extraordinarily simple, and unfortunately I don't have it compiled on here to show you the actual interface, but it's a graphical interface to produce ASCII art. And it was produced by Nadim Kamir, and he had no idea that this thing would be useful. It wasn't, and he showed up at the hackathon. He just happened to mention it offhand, and people were like, "Oh my God, show us this thing! Show us!" And he didn't want to show anybody because it wasn't quite ready. It hadn't been released yet, and da da da. He finally got us, got him to show it to us, and he was so excited about it. He actually got like a cheer. When he was done, they were going, ASCIO. He couldn't have possibly predicted this reaction to it. So what he thought might be crap turned out to be gold. And he finally put out a release of it. Now, Nadim has actually written a whole lot of modules. This is his search page on CPAN, and each line there is an individual module distribution. And he's done a lot of work, but a lot of it hasn't gotten any attention. And ASCIO to him was like, this little side project. And that's the thing that everybody is excited about. And all this stuff is what he thought was really important. And it turns out that, well, it's not. And that happens sometimes. But it means that if you want to answer the question, will this be useful? Will this be useful to other people? People spend a tremendous amount of energy trying to figure this out. And decide, should I release it? Is anybody going to use this thing? And what it turns out is that if you don't show anybody, if you don't release it, you have no information really to figure this out. You're just guessing about what other people will need and what people will want. You can't really predict what other people need and want and use, because you're not those people, and you're not, unless you're like, a population statistics expert. Is anyone a statistician, sociological statistician in the house? No? Okay. You're not going to tell me this is all a load of crap. Right, no information, no release, you'll never know, and you'll spend all this time worrying about it. And what Guy Kawasaki, who was started one of the original people at Apple, says is don't worry, be crappy. Just throw it out there and see what sticks, and the cool thing will rise to the top. And the way I formulate it is release early and release often. Because you don't know what's going to be crap and what's going to be gold, and the best way to find out is just release it. Just send it out there as soon as you have something working, something useful. Doesn't matter if it's buggy or if it's well documented or anything, you can fix it all up later. And that's what the release often part is. You throw out the first, oftentimes I'll release a piece of software and then the next release will come 3 hours later. because I realize that I made a horrible mistake, but it doesn't matter. Nobody's looking at your historical releases. They're gonna, for something that new, they're gonna be looking at the absolute latest up-to-the-minute release. This predicates itself. Well, I should stop, pause for a moment. Are there any questions at this point? I've been barreling on. No? All stunned. Great.
Hey.
Oh, yeah, Marcus.
I was just wondering how your philosophies relate to opinionated web frameworks like Rails and stuff, which tells you this is the right way to do things.
How it relates to big frameworks?
Opinionated frameworks.
Oh, for it's software with a philosophy.
Yeah,
I put that software with a philosophy, and it basically, no, don't do that. Well, the thing about that is that having a very clear philosophy, if it's something that's evolved over time. I mean, Rails didn't just come out of the blue. The CRUD system with a web framework on top of it is actually very well described in space. So, in the terms of Rails, I would say that they already knew pretty much what people want to do, at least at the basic level, and they paved that cow path and set up a 6-lane superhighway on it with a rest stop and an amusement park and pony rides. But yeah, I think in that case, that was just a case of an extremely well-known cow path that they followed along. So if your philosophy is really about we're just going to make this easier by doing it one way, because doing it one way sometimes is very easy, that's fine. And also in that, there are 88 bazillion different web frameworks out there to choose from, each with their own different philosophy. So the system works in that sense. And they're winning by use, although in the long term, we'll see whether or not that works out. It's like, what, Rails has been around for, what, a few years? It's nothing. flash in the pan. All right, yeah, use-based systems are extremely resilient to fads. Because it may look like everybody's piling on to one thing, but in reality, when you look at the actual use, sometimes you can see that only the very visible percentage of people are piling onto one thing, but everybody else is sort of plodding along with the really useful things. One of the things we discovered on CPAN is that one of the most popular modules for Windows users if we took a guess, we would never have guessed this, but it's dead obvious once you see it, is the module that allows you to talk to the Windows API. Everybody, as soon as they download a Windows Perl, they immediately download this module second. It's like, boom, right away, because Windows users really want that, because that's how you operate on Windows. Whereas pro programmers are primarily Unix people, we would never have thought about that. We would never have thought that you want to talk to the Windows API, because we don't know it at all. Right, moving on. Release early, release often is all about, it's predicated on cheap releases. Your system has to allow you to just throw stuff out there. I automate the process, so it just is really easy. So you're not worrying about the cost of the release versus it's not a decision to whether or not you should release. You just release upon, I think it might be useful. There you go. You need very low barriers of entry to your system. CPAN only has two hard set-in-stone requirements, that it's freely redistributable. Doesn't even have to be open source. You can put free for non-commercial use stuff up on there. And then it has something to do with Perl. Doesn't even have to be written in Perl. It just has something vaguely to do with Perl. And we're really loose about that. You need a feedback mechanism so that authors can find out how their module is being used, download statistics, bug reports, patches, critiques, reviews, all this kind of stuff. And that establishes the feedback loop where the author gets this information and makes changes based upon use. And then the whole system starts to evolve because the system is changing based upon actual use. And that becomes a selection mechanism for an evolutionary process where it is following the path of what it actually needs as opposed to what the author thinks it needs, what the philosophy thinks it needs. Which comes into the question of how do you know what people need? In Nadim's case, you know, he came up with this great thing. How did he know whether anybody's going to use it? Well, you don't know. You don't know that. You don't know what other people need. You can spend tremendous amounts of time finding out, but in the end, you really don't know. So what do you know? What can you do? Well, you know yourself, and you know what you need, and you know what you know. You could be your company, your organization, your group, whatever, the people around you. And so instead of writing what other people need, you write what you need, because you know it. And this comes from a concept called, I'm going to butcher it, I think it's called pronounced metis, it's a Greek word, against the idea of generalized systems. And generalized systems, they're global, so they want to apply to everything, which means they have to be very abstract, and they have to be very impersonal. You know, the standard issue human who does these dozen things, and, you know, it doesn't actually work out in reality if you try and apply to an individual. They tend to be speculative, they tend to be big and going into new areas. You know, I'm going to write the new XML parsing framework, or I'm going to write the web is junk. I'm going to write the new thing that's going to replace the web. Lord knows if it's actually going to work. We haven't seen it yet. They tend to be overly simplified because, again, standard issue human, you can't really track what every individual is going to do. And this is a control issue. It's all about control. Simplification allows greater control over a wider area. Governments have to do this all the time with taxation systems. That's why they love to standardize, and thus the ISO thing across the street. And these are really the holy grail projects. GNU Herd, Perl 6. they're useful. You know, while Perl 6 is... sorry to everybody in the video that you just got my thumb in the microphone. While Perl 6 is going on, that's the holy grail, we're still working on Perl 5, and Perl 5 is the Metis. Metis is local information for local use, and it's practical, and it's personal, and it is subjective in the sense that it's for me, or it's for you, it's for a particular subject, it's not abstract. And most importantly, it is necessary. You are doing the work because you need it, not because you think you need it, or you think somebody else needs it. It's about getting things done. And Metis works out really well because you know your problem the best. And you know if the solution fits the best. And you can write what you need. And it's astoundingly effective. And then you write what you need, and then you release it and see if anybody else needs it. And that's the point at which generalization kicks in. You start with Metis, and then you release. And if somebody else needs it, you guys start to work together and work together and work together. And then the generalization happens by following the cow paths. So rather than looking up for help, traditional organizational structure, bureaucratic structure, corporate structure, government structure is that decisions come down the pipe. Decisions, you look up to say what you should do. You ask the person above you, ask the person above him, person above him, person above him, and this creates overgeneralization because you, the programmer sitting there at a computer, or the user on the other end, or the accountant, or using the accounting software, or whatever, they know what they need and they know what they do. So they know the situation best. And if they can, rather than asking, looking, going up the chain of people who don't know their personal job, you look from side to side. You ask the people around you, the people who work with you, who you work with, to coordinate together and figure out what it is that you need to do your local stuff. And then push it up the chain. But the primary thing is work on your stuff. This happens all the time on CPAN. This is my CPAN directory. And only about, I don't know, 6 of those things are really useful to anybody else but me. The rest of them are crap. So even the best, even the 10% that are the best CPAN authors, 90% of what they produce is also crap. But that the last 10% is so useful and so powerful that it's all worth it. And most importantly, all of that is useful to me. I wrote every single one of these things because I need it. So in the end, even though it's crap to everybody else, it's totally useful to me, and it was all worth it. So that's how you can guarantee that. Here we are back to the theme. That's how you can guarantee that even though this stuff can get reused and used in other systems and used by other people and other localities and people you never met before by working for yourself with enlightened self-interest. It's okay to write for yourself, and it's okay to be selfish as long as you then work for yourself and release it to others. And then if it's used, you can adapt it for both situations, for yourself, and then generalize it and generalize it and generalize it for everybody else. And that feeds back typically into your work and makes it more efficient for you. And it's a combination of metis starts the process, and you can't eliminate the first step, which is why we need that 90% of crap to farm from. And then generalization finishes the process by taking that the cream off the top and making it really useful to everybody. Work for yourself, you share with others, if that's the only thing you take away. And that's basically the CPAN philosophy in a nutshell. And as you saw, some of you saw in Adam's talk yesterday, it's worked astoundingly well. So, thank you. No questions, comments, jeers, fruit? No? All right.
I just have one more question.
Yeah.
How much time do you spend on developing all these 10% useful things? Things that are useful to you?
I don't know. I'm really lazy. Not a whole lot. I mean, a lot of the times I'll start it off, I'll kick it off, and then I'll release it, and it'll have a community form around it, and then they'll do all the work, and I'll just apply the patches. So I really don't know. I don't budget my time very well. Not a whole lot, really. Not a whole lot at all. Yeah, a lot of them have been spun off to other authors, so that's the way I deal with that.
Other questions?
I guess I can, there's something I didn't talk about, which was Tess Moore, the evolution of Tess Moore, very briefly. Started out as something that I needed for a contract job, because there were the testing systems at the time for Perl. Well, I didn't know they existed. So I wrote my own thing that was eerily similar to the existing one, and yet slightly better, and which is part of the hubris part of the equation, you know, just do it. And then so many people started to use Tess Moore that they all wanted me to add more and more and more functionality to it. And I was like, I can't handle this anymore. I can't adapt it. No, I don't want to put in an XML parser into it. No, I don't want to put in a database thing to it. Ah! So rather than dealing with that flood and trying to, like, you know, do all this work for myself, if I'm doing lots of work, there's something wrong. And again, I'm selfish, so I don't want to do lots of work for free. I really don't want to do lots of work for free. I know it's strange to say at an open source conference. Instead, I took the guts, the thing that allowed me to write test more, ripped them out into its own module, and then said, and built a generic framework to create more test libraries, and said, here, write your own, go away. And now I just maintain that. So, you know, situation solved by going down a level. Instead of adding another level of abstraction, I went a level lower and provided the framework to do the same thing that I do to everybody else. And there's an explosion of testing modules on CPAN. It went from, you know, like three at the time of Test More that were actually used to, you know, there's 200 and something, and several dozen actually get used. And it's really amazing. Right? No more questions? No? Well, I'm here all for couple more days if anybody wants to grab me. If anyone wants to find out what I was actually going to talk about, I have pages and pages of notes about it. So if anybody's disappointed at the change of topic, I apologize, and I will gladly give you a whole other talk if you want.
Thank you.
Oh, flowers. Yay.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. You like me. You really like me.